We are on chapter 31, and we have this class and one more class, and then on May 28th, which is our last class, because I'm going to be in Israel next week. I actually get back Thursday morning, but I probably won't make it here in time. The flight gets in at 6:30, so if it's at all delayed, I won't make the class. The week after that, which is the 14th, there is the public hearing downtown. I think that's whatever she sent out by email. Dahlia will tell you. And so after this, we have one more class, and then I think we can add the 28th, which is that night is Shavuot. So if you guys want to, we can have a class that morning and just talk about methods of studying the Torah, which is a nice way of ending the year anyway. And then next year, we're going to be doing primarily, not exclusive, but primarily we'll be doing the story of Joseph for most of the year, which is an incredible and fascinating story. I mean, it'll take us a little while to get to it, probably the second half of the year. So if you want a very, very, very long summer reading project, I intend to read it sometime over the summer. You can read the translation of Thomas Mann's Joseph and His Brothers, which is a novel that he wrote, a series of novels actually, but they're all in one volume and it's only like 1,200 pages. Close, dense. Thomas Mann, the great German novelist. His books are not zippy. So if you read Magic Mountain is his greatest work, or the Buddenbrooks. I mean, they're, you know, he was German. What can I tell you? They don't they tend not to write, you know, light speckled stuff. So, all right. We are now in verse, let's say, since we have really two events to get to, we're on verse 17. It says, so thereupon Jacob put his children and his wives on camels. You with me? Yes. Chapter 31, verse 17. Genesis 31, 17. Thereupon Jacob put his children and wives on camels. And he drove off all his livestock and all the wealth he had amassed, the livestock in his possession that he'd acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan, which is pretty amazing. He's going home now. You know, he has everything. And of course, immediately, what's the first thing that's going to occur to you in terms of his going home? Is his father still alive? Presumably he gets family news, but I'm thinking his brother, who never sent him a message saying, you know, I've decided not to kill you. At least as far as we know. Meanwhile, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household idols. Now, why did Rachel steal the idols? Well, let's at least read the story, and then we're going to talk about that, and then next time we'll talk about Laban and the negotiation. Jacob kept Laban the Aramean in the dark, not telling him he was fleeing, and fled with all that he had. Okay? Soon he was across the Euphrates and heading towards the hill country of Gilad. On the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him in the hill country of Gilad. But God appeared to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. Okay? Do you know the Hebrew song Al HaDvash V'Al HaOketz, the Nomi Shemer song, on the honey and the sting? That's based on a Talmudic. It's a beautiful song. Al Kol Eila is the name of the song. It's based on a Talmudic statement that what you say to a guy sticks his hand in a beehive and says, "I want neither your honey nor your sting." He pulls it out. In other words, it's not worth the honey, the pain that I'll go through. And so the point of the Nomi Shemer song is that you'll take the honey and the sting for the land of Israel, right? Al HaDvash V'Al HaOketz, both. But the idea here is that the same thing, the idea of the honey and the sting, that is, you don't want good or bad from Laban. You don't want his honey or his sting. Laban overtook Jacob. Remember, Jacob is traveling with a whole family. Jacob had pitched his tents on the height with Laban, his kinsmen, encamped in the hill country of Gilad. And Laban said to Jacob, what did you mean keeping me in the dark and carrying off my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee in secrecy and mislead me and not tell me? I would have sent you off with festive music, with timbrel and lyre. Yes, exactly. Myrrh and frankincense, too. You didn't even let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye, you miserable. Yeah. It was a foolish thing for you to do. I have it in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father said to me last night, beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. Very well, you had to leave because you were longing for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? Jacob answered Laban, saying, I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. But anyone with whom you find your gods shall not remain alive. In the presence of your kinsmen, point out what I have of yours and take it. Jacob, of course, did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and the tents of the two maidservants, but he didn't find them. Leaving Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Rachel, meanwhile, had taken the idols and placed them in the camel cushion and sat on them. And Laban rummaged through the tent without finding them, for she said to her father, let not my lord take it amiss that I cannot rise before you, for the period of women is upon me. Thus he searched, but could not find the household idols. Now Jacob gets angry with him, but let's stop there for a minute, for more than a minute. So first of all, Laban acknowledges and is even visited by the God of Israel, which is pretty amazing to start off with. Now, it doesn't mean that he only acknowledges the God of Israel, but it means that among the gods whose power he recognizes and pays obeisance to, when the God of Israel comes to him and says, don't do anything to Jacob, he listens to him. Second, this is kind of an interesting play because Laban, who is a pagan, acknowledges the God of Israel, and Rachel, who's supposed to be a monotheist, goes and steals the gods, right? And Laban is clearly a polytheist, otherwise he wouldn't be upset that his gods are gone, right? And the question is why Rachel stole the gods. Now, as you can imagine, most of the Jewish tradition tries to argue that she stole the gods so that Laban wouldn't worship them. She was doing her father a favor, right? She didn't want him to worship the gods, so she stole the gods. It was part of the same way, you know, that when you're a kid, you hide your parents' cigarettes. You don't want them to smoke, so you hide your parents' cigarettes, and you're really doing all right. And then, of course, what they discover is that they're in your room and you're smoking. So this is not, I don't want to suggest that this is based on experience or anything. But that, because if Rachel stole the gods in order that Laban would not worship them, then why did she keep them? The easiest thing to do would be to steal the gods and dump them in a ditch somewhere along the way. The fact that she still has them with her and the fact that she doesn't tell Jacob that she has them with her suggests not only that she still worships them, but also, interestingly, that Jacob doesn't. Otherwise, she would tell him, hey, guess what? Not only do you have the God of Israel, but I've got these gods with me, which would increase his power if he thought the gods were real. Now, it's also possible, and some modern commentators, no classical commentator would ever say such a thing, but some modern commentators say that Jacob didn't like those gods because they were Laban's gods. It's not that Jacob was a monotheist, but he didn't like those gods. You know, everybody has their own configuration of which gods they like. So I thought that the most interesting places to look for today were the commentary on women's behavior, that is, in the Bible. That is, first of all, the five books of Miriam and then the woman's Torah. First of all, this is what they say. Tragically, Jacob's curse, of course, is fulfilled. You know that that's true. Rachel dies, right? Rachel dies giving birth to her son Benjamin, and the wheel of fortune continues to turn. That son is eventually entrapped by a mock theft. Remember Benjamin in the story of Joseph? They accuse Benjamin of stealing the cup, which he doesn't do. When Joseph plants his own goblet in his younger brother's sack. In other words, Benjamin, who dies, Rachel dies in childbirth giving birth to Benjamin. Later, Benjamin is accused of a theft he didn't commit. Here, Rachel is freed from a theft that she did commit, right? Laban doesn't find out. And then Esther, here, the hidden one reveals, as with so many patterns, this curse, once fulfilled, overturns itself to become a blessing. Benjamin's crime, quote unquote, unknots the sibling jealousies aroused by his mother's privileged status and reunites the brothers. That is, because Benjamin does that, the brothers come back and they get reunited with Joseph, and she says, thus even idols can be redeemed. So there is clearly a larger pattern at work here with Rachel stealing the idols that leads, of course, to, maybe leads to her death because Jacob curses her. It's like almost like a Greek myth here where she can't escape the curse that Jacob has put on her because she didn't tell him that she stole the idols. And which is her crime, if there is one, was it stealing the idols or not telling Jacob that she stole the idols? We can gain a hint of Rachel's presumed motive, why she did this, from the 14th century BCE tablets of Nuzi, an ancient city in Iraq. This was a huge cache of tablets which illuminated a lot of stuff about the Bible. Here's a good example. Evidence there suggests the possession of household gods was associated with clan leadership or inheritance rights. In other words, if you get the gods, you get the inheritance. Thus, Rachel, like Jacob before her, deceives the father in order to gain tokens of power and authority. Once again, Rachel is a counterpart to Jacob. She may have also sought the Trophim to serve as fertility gods, hoping for a second child. Remember, she only has one child thus far, so maybe she wants more children. The Torah includes a number of trickster stories like this, showing how marginalized men or women outwit the powerful in order to survive or safeguard justice. Okay, so when God came to Lavan the Aramean in a dream, that this is the third in a series of dreams in which God guides, bless you, and protects Jacob. So the other two possible motivations for Rachel stealing the idols are that their fertility or that they're a symbol of inheritance. Because remember, Lavan is coming to Jacob in part to contest his inheritance, and Jacob runs away because he thinks Lavan, realistically or unrealistically, that Lavan is going to take his wives from him. The last part of this is, why is it that Lavan? The other part of it, of course, is how Rachel hides the Trophim, the idols from Lavan, by saying that she's having her period. And the period is not only a symbol in the Bible of impurity, but also, of course, of fertility. So what strikes me about this is if you look at the verse again, look at verse 33. So Lavan went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and the tents of the two maidservants, but he didn't find them. Leaving Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. So what does that tell you? Rachel was the last place he looked. First, he distrusted Jacob. When Jacob didn't have the idols, next he distrusts Leah. Next, he distrusts the maidservants. And only at the very, very end does he go into Rachel's tent. I mean, first of all, it's interesting that he distrusts Jacob and Leah more than the maidservants, right? But also, what is there about Rachel that wins his trust so much so that also when she says, you know, I can't stand up, he doesn't say, you know, I'll wait or move aside or, you know, I mean, he knows that women don't sit all day and all night when they have their period. He's had daughters, right? So, but he trusts Rachel, which is quite remarkable. Of course, that's essential if you're going to trick somebody, is that they trust you, right? It's very hard to trick someone who doesn't trust you. And that's part of Jacob's tricking of his father, was that his father trusted his children. Otherwise, he would have been more suspicious. And also, presumably, part of Rachel and Leah's tricking Jacob, which was he couldn't believe that it wasn't Rachel in his bed because he trusted Rachel. He never had any reason to distrust her. So it must be Rachel in his bed, even if it didn't seem like Rachel. And I just found that, you know, it's, you know, there is this expression. I remember the comedian David Brenner once did a whole riff on the fact that people always say when they find their keys, they say it was in the last place, you know, that I looked. He says, well, who keeps on looking after you found it? Right? Obviously, it's in the last place you looked. But the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that he looked every place other than Rachel until in Rachel's tent, the Trophim are there, but they're not found. And What is also interesting about this is that although Jacob condemns the theft, the Bible never condemns the fact that Rachel took idols, unless you see her death as the Bible's verdict on what she did, which is possible, although the Bible doesn't make that explicit connection. I mean, it could be that that's what's going on. And if that's true, let's just play this out for a second. Let's say it's true that Rachel dies because, not because she took the idols, but because of Jacob's curse. It throws Jacob's life, subsequent life, into a whole different light. Right? Why does he favor Joseph so much? Because he feels responsible for Joseph's mother's death. Right? And why is it that he says the years of his life, when he says to Pharaoh at the end of his life, the years of my life have been few and bitter? And why is it that he's so willing to believe that Joseph dies when the brothers bring that to him? I mean, just imagine if he thinks that his rash words were what caused his wife to die in childbirth with his second son, right? Jacob becomes a tragic figure that way, as does Rachel, for that matter. But Rachel's already a tragic figure because she dies young. And so if it's true, and again, the Bible never says, because the Bible doesn't make comments like that, but if it's true that Jacob's curse is what kills Rachel, then you can understand why Jacob's subsequent life is shadowed by that forever. Finally, the only other thing that I want to talk about for a second is the fact that Laban overtakes Jacob. And what is Laban's original intention? So you've got to assume that Laban intends to hurt him, because God wouldn't come to Laban in a dream and say, don't do anything to him, if he didn't intend to hurt him in the first place, right? If he's just coming to him to say, you know, I didn't get a chance to say goodbye, really wanted to say goodbye, wish you all the best, it was great working with you. So God wouldn't come to him in a dream. And I think that Tov V'ra is, this is one interpretation of the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden. I think Sarna says this, that good and evil is supposed to mean everything. It's like saying from A to Z, right? When you say, you know, we cover from soup to nuts is the English, although I don't know why that's the English expression, but I guess soup was at the beginning of the meal and nuts at the end. So from soup to nuts, from A to Z, in other words, everything conceivable. When you say the tree of knowledge of good and evil, according to one interpretation, it means the tree of knowledge of all things, right? Night and day is another example of that parallel that is supposed to include everything. So when God says don't do anything to him, good or bad, it might just mean don't touch him at all, right? Don't do what you think would be good. In other words, God might not really be saying, Laban, don't benefit him, but rather saying, I don't trust your judgment. I don't want you to do anything you think is good. I don't want you to do anything you think is bad. Leave him alone, okay? Which is, to draw an analogy, that's exactly what you say to little kids, right? When a baby is born and you have a little kid and he says, oh, I want to help my brother, you say, don't help him, right? Don't help him, don't hurt him, don't touch him, right? Until the kid is old enough to actually, right. So then you might say the same thing, depending on what the relation, you know, is between the children, right? So I think that that's what the idea is here, is that God is not actually admonishing Laban not to help Jacob, but he's saying, leave him alone, don't touch him. And the fact that Laban still goes and sees him, you know, is a function of Laban's ego. He can't stand the idea of not going there and making Jacob feel bad and maybe not getting his idols back, which he can do without injuring Jacob. Those are the major themes before we have the negotiation and the comments, which I'm going to talk about next time, between Jacob and Esau, between Jacob and Laban, which more or less wrap up this chapter, how they deal with each other. But really, the key character in this chapter is Rachel, because she's the one that steals the idols. She's the one that Laban trusts, and she's at least ostensibly the reason that he comes after them, whether he comes after him because Jacob took the daughters away or because Rachel took the idols. Either way, she's the catalyst for the action as she has been before, and for that matter, in some ways will be again. Okay, so questions, comments? Yeah, okay, we'll go across. Yeah.
Why does Laban say the God of your father instead of your God?
I think that's often people refer to God as the God of your father. That's how God comes to Moses too, right? I'm the God of your father. So presumably it means your ancestral God, I guess. And that is that how does God identify God's self? Doesn't, right? Right, God came to Laban. So I guess that's what it means, is your ancestral God, as opposed to, it might be that he doesn't identify God with Jacob's God particularly, but rather with the God of sort of Jacob's house. So, yeah.
I have several, so I'll narrow it to just one. But where it says, so Laban went into Jacob's tent, and Leah's tent, tents of the two maidservants, but after the next sentence says, leaving Leah's tent, he went and entered Rachel's tent. Does that mean he went back into Leah's tent?
I don't know. It's a good question. It's a good question. Yes. He returned to Leah's tent.
He returned to the tent of Rachel before he searched in the maidservant's tent.
He returned to the tent of Rachel before the maidservant's tent.
After he went out of Leah's tent, he returned to the tent of Rachel.
But it doesn't... Okay. Maybe he's... He may be assuming that, although it doesn't say that in the text. Okay. But he made a round of all the tents. What can I tell you? But if your observation, if we follow it out, so that means he went to Leah's tent. He didn't find it. He went to the tent of the maidservants. He didn't find it. He went back to Leah's tent. Before he went to Rachel's, because it was inconceivable. One thing he knew was his little girl didn't steal his idols, right? Maybe the older one, you know, who's the troublemaker, but not Rachel, which actually goes against family sibling systems theory, right? It's usually the older one is usually the conservative one and the preserver of order, and that's exactly what's true, what happens here. It's usually the younger, if you have two, who's the more rebellious, who wants to overturn the order, and that makes sense because the way this works, at least in theory, is that when you're the younger child, you don't like the established order, right? The established order is parents and older child. So you always want to upend the established order. Whereas if you're the older child, the established order is fine with you, and it's this younger one who came along and usurped the established order. And that's why, you know, this guy Frank Soloway, wrote a book where he argues that all the great revolutionaries through history have always been younger children, because older children are not inclined to be revolutionaries. And there was a lot of debate about the book, and I don't know if it's true or not, but anyway, it's interesting to think about. Okay, so we're going across. No? Yes?
Rachel stole the idols as revenge towards her father because he usurped her when he let
Leah
marry Jacob first.
Right. It's a plausible theory that she does it to infuriate her father, although it still doesn't explain why she didn't dump them. You know, because that's all right, to draw a bad analogy, you know, if you want to hurt someone, what you do is destroy what they love, mm-hmm. not, you know, keep it and preserve it and use it. So I would say this. There's no reason why Rachel has to do this for one motivation alone. She could be doing it to hurt her father, to have the idols with them, and maybe, here's a possibility. Maybe she's not so secure in Jacob's love and caring for her. So she keeps the idols to keep a bit of her home with her because she doesn't know what her status is in Jacob's home. After all, she only has one son, and Leah's, you know, manufacturing them at an alarming rate. So, yeah.
First of all, I think Rachel is trusted by her father most because she listened to him rather than, and when they deceived Jacob in the first place.
Right.
So he said, well, if she's going to do that, then I know she would never take my idols. I think my first thought about her motivation for taking the idols and keeping the idols is possibly as bargaining power if her father follows them and says, you know,
right.
Well, either trying to take her back, well, I'll give you the idols, mm-hmm. and let us go with everything that we have. So that was my
it idea. Is possible that, right, their leverage, although she doesn't use them that way, and she doesn't tell Jacob about it.
Well, but I think she,
right.
I think she knows that Jacob would say, get
would
rid
be
of
upset.
Those idols, we
right.
don't want them, we're monotheists, you know,
yeah. So, and by the way, it never says later that she consults the idols either, which is another interesting omission. She never gets rid of them, but she never uses them, at least not as far as we know. But we should also point out, before I take the next comment, that every excavation in ancient Israel always turns up all these little figurines, you know, especially fertility gods. And this is exactly what you would expect if you read the Bible, because the prophets are always saying, stop worshiping idols. Well, they wouldn't do that if the Israelites weren't worshiping idols. So that's what they're spending their time doing. And she steals the idols probably because she thinks they work. I mean, that's the most likely scenario. And the fact that there is this ancestral God of Israel is great. But remember that the polytheistic mindset isn't that the worship of one god eliminates the worship of other gods. It's that it gets added to the worship of other gods. It's like membership in the synagogue. You know, when we get a new member, we don't kick someone out. We say, it's great. The more people, the better. Because it just accretes your power to have more. So the more idols you have, the more powerful you are. And maybe Rachel thinks she's in a struggle with Leah. And she needs maybe she thinks she needs a little help. So she's, yeah, Miriam. Which sentence?
What? One that says, if you find the gods, then I would kill. So he never found it, so that means he doesn't have to.
Right. That is true. Right. The commentators do say that it says, if anybody you find the gods with shall die. Mm-hmm. Right. And he doesn't find the gods with it. So that's, yes, you're right, that Jacob does have an out. Yeah, it's true. Nuance.
Approach to the story, it strikes me that throughout these two pages, we have God as judge and or a higher authority, or whether divine or not. We have,
sounds like a Hebrew National commercial.
God of, God of Abraham, fear of Isaac.
Right.
When he explains why, then he says, you're God. Then we have the household gods, and then they set up. And then also, it seems to me we're delineating legally who did what and why, what were the higher powers involved, and we were setting up a whole new nation as almost. I mean, he's leaving Laban, he's delineating who he is, why he is who he is, and he's going, you know, he's separating from.
Well, Jacob is about to be Israel, yes. And he is separating of the God of Israel from the gods of Laban. And it is probably true that if you live in Laban's house, you can't escape idolatry. I mean, it's all around the place. The idols are everywhere in the household gods. And the fact that Jacob is about to become Israel, which will happen in his struggle with Esau shortly, and that his children now are, I mean, who will be the tribes of Israel are born. All of that does suggest, yeah, that there's this critical separation taking place, because even though Jacob is going home, he's now where the action is, right? Isaac isn't anymore. Isaac is basically irrelevant now to the history of Israel. It's all about Jacob and his children. So yes, that's true. And Laban also no longer matters, right? And you see the extent to which Laban matters only because he intersects in Jacob's life. He doesn't matter on his own. He's like an extra in the movie. He only matters, you know, because he's a supporting actor, right? The other thing that we didn't mention specifically, although everybody sort of assumes it, is that God's coming to Laban and saying, don't hurt Jacob. Is God's realization, or one of the realizations, of his promise. Remember, he said to Jacob, I will take care of you, and I'll watch out over you, and wherever you go, I'll be there, and I will be with you. On the most restrictive reading, it was, I'll be with you until you come back home again, right? And Jacob's not home again. So the only person now that poses a threat to Jacob is Laban. And God intervenes, and he intervenes in a dream, which of course is how God comes especially to non-Jewish prophets or non-exalted prophets, whatever, in a dream. And so he says, and the other thing that I'm curious about is in verse 28, it says, "You didn't even let me kiss my sons and my daughters goodbye." Well, we only know about his daughters unless he's referring to his grandsons as his sons, which could be because they grew up in his house. But it also the other thing is that Laban does have a legitimate complaint.
Sure.
You know, he didn't threaten Jacob, and Jacob did run off in the middle of the night, and he did run off with his kids and with his grandchildren. And as somebody who frequently hears the struggles between children and grandchildren, between children and grandparents about grandchildren, I can tell you that this is not, you know, this is a sort of paradigm of the kind of thing that happens, which is the exercise of parental power by parents over children is deeply offensive in some way to grandparents because they raised children. And it's very hard to completely sever your ties such that you don't have any right to exercise that power, since after all, you're the grandparent, you're older, and so on. And all I can tell you is, not having been a grandparent and therefore not having had that experience, it's almost always a mistake. Almost always a mistake. And what you have to remember as a grandparent is your own resentment when you were a parent, of the way in which parents interfered with you, because there's a natural desire for autonomy over one's own family and one's own children. That's why grandparents tend to enter the indulgent role, because the controlling role doesn't work, but the indulgent role does work, right? But you can imagine that Laban doesn't do well in the indulgent role, right? So he's trying the controlling role, which is, how can you take my daughters away from me? But they're not his daughters anymore, not legally. They're Jacob's wives. And that's how Jacob could do this. And instead of saying, I'm sad that you did, right? Laban reacts like Laban, which is, first of all, with what is probably a lie, that he would have sent them off with timbrels and festive music. But who knows? Maybe he would. Maybe would you remember? This is the same Laban who tried to keep Rebecca, right? And Rebecca escaped. Do you remember that? They wanted Rebecca to stay for a few days, and she said, "I'll see you later." The same Laban. Now he wants his daughters to stay, and they're also running away. So there's something not entirely kosher in Laban's house. That's all I can. Yeah.
Getting back to the idea of the trickery that Rachel used. It's reminiscent of Jacob and the trickery that he used.
Right.
If you use the idols as the birthright, which is what you read in one of the commentaries, mm-hmm. then, you know, maybe she's thinking, we're leaving my father's house. I got to go. I got to take my birthright in the same way that Jacob took his birthright.
It does. It makes sense. The mechanism is different, but the attempt to get the birthright or the inheritance is similar. The thing that you have to ask yourself in all these stories is why. I mean, the easiest answer is just because it happened that way and it's true. But more interestingly, why would the Torah portray all these paradigms as, I don't know, I don't want to say dishonest, because that dishonest isn't exactly the right word, as shady, right? I mean, there's so much deception in what Jacob does and in what Jacob does with Isaac, and in what Rachel and Leah do with Jacob, and in what Laban does with Jacob, and then what Jacob does back with them. It's quite remarkable. Yeah.
I think the Bible illustrates human nature, and that is all part of human nature.
It is part of human nature, but there are other parts of human nature that it doesn't illustrate. Why does it choose these? I mean, human nature is too big. There's got to be a reason why it picks this part of human nature.
Because I think people learn more from things that are not right, are morally is always right. They learn more from...
That also may be true, but you still, you can learn more from bad characters. They can introduce all sorts of bad characters who do bad things. Why do they pick, in particular, deception and trickery over and over again in these characters who are supposed to be, I mean, specifically, these characters who are supposed to be paradigms for us? And I don't have an answer up my sleeve. It's just, yeah.
I mean, is the whole thing a ground for the Ten Commandments?
Maybe.
She said, don't, she stole the idols. And then in Hebrew it says, and the Jacob stole the
right.
But there's a lot of, maybe it's all getting us ready for the Ten Commandments, and we really need that.
Do not steal.
Yeah, it could be. Although there's some things that, you know, aren't exactly, doesn't say don't substitute one woman for another in the middle of the night. especially if they're sisters, right? Yeah. Yes. Yes, right. I'm glad you mentioned that. I meant to talk about that, and I didn't. I'm going to assume that by now Jacob and his wives lead somewhat separate lives, and that there's a large property, and that they don't interact every day. Yeah, I would assume that that's true. It does, though, make it less plausible that he's so upset. How could you possibly run away? You know, when he doesn't even know for 3 days. And after 3 days, he has to be told. It's not like he notices, hey, Jacob's not at the dinner table.
I would think that with the kind of ego he has, he's probably insulted that he didn't come.
Right. I that would be my guess, too, and pay obeisance to the Godfather.
Why didn't he say goodbye?
Why didn't he say goodbye?
Jacob's?
Oh,
yes.
He would have tricked somebody 10 times.
But again, okay, so that would be the normal reaction, but that means that he doesn't feel secure in God's protection, right? Because if God was going to protect him, he would go and say goodbye because he knows that God is protecting him. So...
Did Laban have any sons?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask, in verse 29, he comes right out of the Laban and says, why did you steal my gods?
Yes. Yes, he's clearly a polytheist, right? Is that, yeah. I mean, I think that there's no doubt about it. But also, I don't know. I don't know why Jacob wouldn't, I mean, I assume that it would be out of fear.
I don't need to say goodbye.
Right. Or maybe it is also possible that he's not afraid. Maybe he just hates him. He just can't stand the guy and doesn't want to say goodbye and wants to leave and wants to take, now that he's got his money, he wants to leave, he wants to go home where people still care about him, and he doesn't, he spent 14 years there, it's enough already, he doesn't want to spend one more day. It's like getting out of jail, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That he went off to the sheep shearing festival in Scotland.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I suppose that's true. Maybe Jacob waited until he went off shearing sheep. Right. Yep. So I suppose that's true, and it says what? That, yeah.
In the commentary, it says in Mesopotamia, sheep shearing took place in the spring and entailed much hard work. It often had to labor at a considerable distance from their homes for extended periods of time. Mm-hmm. So Laban and his sons and his menfolk were preoccupied and far away, and it was an ideal time for Jacob to make.
For Jacob to leave. So maybe in fact Jacob was constantly expected, sort of at the dinner table, and. But you do have to imagine this. Laban has sons and he has a household, and Jacob probably thinks, if I wait for them to come back and then I say goodbye, it's going to be a long, drawn-out, difficult thing at best. Don't leave. We love you. We want you to stay. I mean, so they just left. Mm-hmm. It's just easier. Yes.
It just seems to me, that Laban clearly would never have let him leave. Mm-hmm. power structure okay. that's there.
The only other thing I'll say, not that, probably not, but the only other thing that is, if you want to make a sort of psychological profile of Jacob, he's someone who runs away.
Yeah.
Yes. He didn't wait for Esau to come home and confront him about what he did.
Right.
His mother said, run away, and Jacob ran away. Right? And now, when he has the chance to run away from Laban, he runs away. And he doesn't seem to be one of those people who wants to get into emotional confrontations, right? When Rachel says, give me a kid, he says, oh, don't bother me about that. Leave me alone, right? In other words, there's another word for what Jacob is, a man, right? Okay? He doesn't want to be emotionally confrontational, and he wants to just run away. It's like, for example, before there was email, remember how men broke up? They broke up by not calling,
yeah.
right? That's how men break up. They don't break up by calling and saying, I know that we've had a lot of good time, but in fact, no, because it's messy and it's uncomfortable. And they did this survey years ago that all men should know about, that fighting takes physically a greater toll on the male body than the female body. Uh-huh. And that men physically, out of self-preservation, are not confrontational. They don't talk things through because actually their blood pressure rises more, their heart beating increases more, all this stuff, right? Which is actually very interesting. Well, but whether it's physiological or not, that makes sense that's what Jacob does. He doesn't want a confrontation. He just wants it over. Mm-hmm. Yes. Maybe.
Because, somebody who just ups and leaves and takes wives, money.
That takes some planning, yeah. Yeah, it does take some planning. It's true.
Yeah. Wouldn't Laban have been suspicious anyway if, why didn't Jacob go and take his sheep to shear if it's the time of year to go sheep your sheep? Shear.
Say that 10 times real fast. I don't know. I don't know enough about the mechanics of how it, right, exactly, I'm not even saying it, about that practice. No, I don't know enough about the mechanics of it. Maybe different flocks, they do it at different times of the year, or maybe he would take his flock and then Jacob would take his. I don't know. I just don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, what are we to learn from these people?
And on that note, I think that's the thrust of the rabbinic tradition. Is the rabbis interpret the Bible in order for people to learn from it, as opposed to, we're really doing a lot of, let's learn about human nature from these characters. The rabbis are more interested in, let's learn about leading a good life from these characters. And their lessons are pretty consistently, follow God's word, believe in God's protection, trust that God will get you through it, know that you should keep far from dishonest polytheistic sorts of people, that God is starting to build Israel here, and that Jacob ultimately is good and kind and faithful and all those things, and that's the way you're supposed to be too. I mean, I'm making it too simple, but that's what the rabbis would have us learn from it. Someone I think it's certainly true that you could interpret Jacob's action as arising out of fear, Rachel stealing the idols as arising out of fear, Laban's actions not. I mean, fear is a very broad category. I don't know if it embraces ego and offense and hurt. You could say that's fear too, but you could say it otherwise. Here the rabbi's formula of this would be that you should not fear human beings, you should fear only God, right? But remember that fear of God in the Jewish tradition is not fear like, oh, I'm afraid God's going to hit me. It's I always think of it as yirah, which is the word that the rabbis use, is awe, but in the following way. That is, the analogy that I use with kids is if you see one of these movies, like where King Kong appears in the streets of New York, and someone sees King Kong, it's not in the first minute that they see him. They don't think, oh my God, that thing's going to step on me. What they feel is awe that such a creature could actually exist. They're awestruck, thunderstruck. It's that, and there's an element of reverence in it. It's like, oh my God, look at that. And then they're going to get stepped on. But that's what yirah is. It's awe and reverence that God is in the world. And it can get very quickly reduced to, oh, I better be nice to God or God will step on me. But that's a much lower level of a religious approach to God than just being in God's presence is awesome.
It seems to me that all the stories, all the people that are involved in this, that God is a universal puppeteer in the creation of man's actions in this situation. So somewhere one thinks that the actions of Jacob and all were sort of orchestrated for the long-term follow-up results.
So this, by the way, this is right at the heart of a central argument that runs throughout the Jewish tradition, which is how much is God and how much is us. And here, the one note that I'll make about the Bible in particular, which is the subject of a really interesting book by Richard Elliot Friedman, actually, called The Disappearing God, is if you go through the Tanakh, okay, and what makes this so interesting is, I'll tell you why this is particularly interesting that Friedman wrote this, and he says it himself, but if you go through the Tanakh, almost perfectly, God gradually disappears until you get to the very end in like books of Esther where God's not there at all, right? God isn't even mentioned. And what Friedman says is that, he traces it book after book after book. In other words, the human role expands and the divine role contracts, okay? In almost perfect lockstep as you go through the Bible. And Friedman says in his book, he wrote a book called Who Wrote the Bible? Richard Elliot Friedman. It was a best-selling book, and it argues that human beings wrote the Bible, and it uses evidence in the Bible to try to say that people wrote the Bible and not God. So he writes in this book about the disappearing God, he says, I'm a modern critical scholar. I wrote a book about how people wrote the Bible. He said, and I think that the Bible was gradually put together over a period of 1,000 years. It's not that all of a sudden one day God said, okay, this is the way the books are. He says, so I find it a particular challenge to explain how is it possible that the Bible is so arranged that it follows this perfect pattern over all these books of God disappearing and the human role expanding. It's very interesting to read. So anyway. One, two, and then we'll wrap it up.
Maybe when you were talking about being in awe,
yes,
fear or your awe,
yeah,
because you can't exactly translate it to
right
English.
No.
Maybe it could be used as be aware.
Yeah, it's an awareness. It's an awareness that has, though, something, right. What Heschel calls it radical amazement. That's his term for it.
Oh, that's great.
Right, radical amazement. So, which is, which he says is the basis of true religion, is awe, wonder, radical amazement. If you haven't read any Heschel, you really are doing yourself a great disservice in this world. Any one of his books, but God in Search of Man, and I'll tell you, and this is what I would say about Heschel. The Sabbath, by the way, is the most immediately accessible book, and it's very short. What I would say, with the exception of the Sabbath, about Heschel is you don't have to read him from page 1 to page 250. Open and read almost any paragraph. Heschel is an anthology of Heschel's writings, right? Only people who teach Heschel tend to read him from beginning to end. So when I teach Heschel, I read his books from beginning to end. But any other time, you can just open it on any page. You get stuff like Heschel. I mean, this is just random stuff from Heschel, who says you can't see that God speaks slowly in your life, a syllable at a time. And it isn't until you get to the end of life that you can read the sentence backwards.
Oh.
Heschel's full of stuff like that. So awe, wonder, radical amazement, he talks a lot about that and really is. And he says, by the way, the Bible is the chronicle of God's search for human beings. That's what the Bible tells, the story of God looking for us, right? That's Heschel's sense of the Bible. And he says, and when someone asked him if God wrote the Bible, you know, the rabbis, he never answered the question. You know, the rabbis' stories about the Bible are called Midrash, right? When someone asked Heschel if God wrote the Bible, what he said was the entire Bible is a Midrash. So take that however you will. He didn't say who wrote it. He didn't say people wrote it, God wrote it. He just said the entire Bible is a Midrash. He's a very interesting character. I'll tell you one quick story about him after I take the last. Yeah, go ahead. Right. I like that idea.
The other comment is, I don't think we talked about it, but it was really only when Joseph was born that Jacob decides he wants to go home. So I think there's something about...
Right, Joseph being the one who will carry on.
Right, that causes him to remember who he is, where he came from, what he's doing here, and...
That's very nice. I like both comments, and it also ties it into Egypt. You can, both your comments can, beautiful. Okay, so last story about Heschel. At the end of Heschel's life, he did an interview on PBS with Carl Stern. I think it's still available, although it's very hard. In fact, someone just made a documentary about Heschel, and I have a copy of the documentary. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. When it comes to LA, though, I'll tell you about it. So he made an interview with Carl Stern shortly before he died, and I think he died in 72. So towards the end of the documentary, Stern says to him, why should people be good? Now, you can answer that any way you want, and then I'll tell you how Heschel answered it, okay? Heschel didn't answer it as I would have answered it, or I think any of us would have. Heschel said, people should be good because when we are bad, it causes God pain, and we ought not to cause God pain. It was very powerful and beautiful. But, I mean, Heschel just, he came from a long line of Hasidic rabbis, and then he was trained at German universities. So he had both modern critical learning, and also his grandfather was a very famous Hasidic rabbi named Abraham Joshua Heschel of Opt, the Opta Rebbe, and his name was Abraham Joshua Heschel. So he grew up in that world. Anyway, okay.
How would you
see you next time.